Thank you, Philip. And I want to thank Jean-Jacques and the Collège de France for organizing this. But Jean-Jacques, you did not tell me that the audience was going to be so tough on us with such long and difficult questions. So I want to talk a little bit about Neanderthal energetic ecology and demography and the thing that links the two together, reproduction. But I have to confess that I'm a man in a little bit of a crisis right now, because the way that energetic ecology and demography are linked through reproduction has become less clear to me. And part of the reason, the person to blame is sitting in the front row, and he's coming up to speak after me, Herman Ponzer, who has kind of made my life more difficult. But thankfully, I took great heart in Cecile's presentation, because it tells me there still are definable links between energy, ecology, activity, and fertility. But I want to begin by telling you about two observations which I believe are linked. And the first observation is that the cost of living was high for Neanderthals. The metabolic or energetic cost of living was high for Neanderthals. They had very effective adaptive solutions to Ice Age Europe, to the thermoregulatory constraints that they faced, and to the distribution of energy and the ecological problems. But they were metabolically expensive adaptations. They had cold-adapted bodies, which had high mass, very muscular bodies with short limbs. That results in a high basal metabolic rate because of their high lean body mass, high thermoregulatory costs. We think of this body form as being great for conserving energy, but it has absolutely a lot of surface area. So it loses a lot of heat, which means you've got to generate a lot of heat. Great for keeping a constant temperature, but not good at conserving energy. Very high cost of transport because of that high mass and short limbs. Patricia Kramer has estimated that per unit distance, it took Neanderthals about 30% more energy than it took a modern human. They also had foraging systems which required high mobility, so they had high physical activity levels. Combine that with the high cost of transport, and you can see the kind of problem that we're talking about. And as John Speth will talk to you about more, they probably had fairly protein-rich diets, and so a very high thermogenic effect of food, a high cost of digesting protein. So that's one observation. The second observation, which I think is linked to that, is that Neanderthals lived at low population densities. And there is a lot of evidence that points to that. In any given region, there are a low number of sites for Neanderthals, whether you're looking absolutely or per unit time, relative to modern humans of even the very first period of the Upper Paleolithic, the Aurignacian. Those sites also tended to be very small, to have small occupation areas, low faunal abundance per unit time, indicating that there were fewer people eating, low lithic abundance per unit time. And we know from ancient DNA that Neanderthals also had low genetic diversity, which is consistent with their having lived at low population densities. So all these things seem to point to very, very low population density. The effects of this low population density, their metapopulations, which is simply the number of Neanderthal individuals living at any given time, have been estimated to have been in the tens of thousands. And if you think about the aerial extent, the geographic range over which we find the Neanderthals, that basically equates with a population density which is similar to historically known foragers in the high Arctic, above the Arctic Circle. That's very low population density. And that means that they probably lived in small and relatively isolated social groups, and they lacked the kind of both population density and interconnectedness between social groups that allows for rapid cumulative technological evolution. They probably had relatively high inbreeding coefficients, and they probably had frequent local group extinctions, such that during climatic downturns where parts of Europe were covered by ice sheets, like marine isotope stages 6 or 4, parts of Europe probably became depopulated of Neanderthals. They probably went locally extinct in several areas, and the Mediterranean coast probably served as a more stable location for a source population, and periodically the rest of Europe would be repopulated from that source population. So the evidence suggests that they weren't able to maintain stable populations over much of Europe. And this, of course, makes them vulnerable to extinction and may be a big part of why they disappeared during marine isotope stage three. So I think that these two things, high metabolic adaptive strategies and low population density, are linked. But first, why do they live at low population density? Well, a big part of this is that it's been inferred that they had high adult mortality. There were probably a lot of potent sources of mortality for adult Neanderthals, from obstetric complications through hunting accidents, predation, starvation, hypothermia. And it's been worked out, based on the age representation of fossils in the Neanderthal fossil record, that of the individuals that survived to age 20, 80% of them died before they reached age 40. Another way to put that is about 5 to 15% of every cohort of Neanderthals that was born survived beyond the age of 40. Very, very high adult mortality. And that suggests that they needed very high fertility in order to maintain stable populations. Demographic modeling that's been done by a guy named Bent Sorensen suggests that a Neanderthal female needed a completed fertility of close to 8 live births in order to maintain stable populations at these mortality rates over any period of time. That's very high for foraging people. It's not outside the range of extant foragers, but it is very close to the upper end of the range. And for extant foragers, 42 groups that we have data for, the average completed fertility is 5.6 children. So they had metabolically expensive adaptive strategies. I also think because in most places, in Europe at least, over the Neanderthal range, they were probably heavily meat dependent. That doesn't mean that that's all that they were eating, but they were largely dependent to some degree on meat in their diet. And there was a very, very rich guild of carnivores that they were competing with. And those two things meant that they had very tight energy budgets. Those energy budgets, I think, constrained their fertility. Because of high adult mortality, they needed high fertility, but they were unable to attain high fertility, and this led to low population density and unstable populations, at least at times and in places during the Neanderthal reign. But what I want to explore a little bit more is this relationship between energy budgets and low fertility, because this is where I'm starting to have some problems. And again, the problems sort of stem from the work of Hermann Panzer. So this is the way that we've always sort of traditionally approached energy budgets, what we call additive total energy expenditure models. This is the world BP before Panzer. And, you know, basically we tended to imagine total energy expenditure, the daily energy that an individual uses, is their maintenance energy, which is mostly basal metabolic rate with some other things thrown in, plus the energy that they're expending on physical activity. And so by this model, you know, here's your maintenance activity here in light gray, and as physical activity increases, total energy expenditure increases in a linear and proportional way. And so by this kind of model, it was easy to sort of look at Neanderthal energy budgets because we could use a factorial method where we used data from modern foragers and we made some assumptions about Neanderthal mobility and other activities to come up with a physical activity level multiplier, and we could estimate their body mass from, or their basal metabolic rate from their body mass, and come up with estimates of total energy expenditure. So by this kind of model, you could look at energy expenditure in simple ways like this. So this is just a yearly cumulative energy demands for two females, a Neanderthal female in blue and an early modern European female in purple. The solid line represents a non-pregnant, non-lactating female. The dotted line assumes 9 months of pregnancy and 3 months of lactation. And what you can see is, in either condition, the Neanderthal female requires more energy, both to maintain herself and to reproduce. Over here, the graph is in kilocalories, but over here I put it in units of reindeer. By simply taking the nutritional value of the edible parts of an average-sized reindeer. And so, you know, whether pregnant or not, a Neanderthal female needed about 2 additional reindeer a year in order to maintain herself and to reproduce. Here's another kind of conclusion that this approach leads to. This is work that I did with Andy Froehlich, where we basically looked at the demand across a female's reproductive lifespan. We simply lined up the Neanderthal and the modern human. But the thing about a female is that she starts off only having to maintain herself. She has one child. She's now got a dependent that she's got to provision through lactation. She weans the dependent child, but she's still responsible for feeding that child when baby number 2 comes along. So there comes a point in her reproductive career where she has the maximum number of dependents that she can support as well as herself. And we estimated that at the peak of her reproductive career, a Neanderthal female would require about 800 additional kilocalories per day than a modern human female with the same number of babies. And so it was easy to sort of think about that in terms of demographics, because we know from demographic modeling that small changes in fertility and small changes in mortality can have very, very big demographic consequences. So it was sort of easy to think about this as being a problem of energy supply and thus reduced fertility. But then, of course, Herman had to go and ruin everything for us by showing that the Hadza, who are physically very active. Hadza males may move as much as 20 kilometers, walk 20 kilometers in a day, they have the same total energy expenditures per unit body mass as Western sedentized people who live in high-calorie environments. And what this basically shows us, what Herman has been able to demonstrate, is that as physical activity goes up, initially total energy expenditure goes up, but then eventually it levels off, which means that energy expended to other functions has got to be scaled back so that the physical activity energy can be provided. So this is what we call a constrained energy model, and you can imagine it makes a lot of adaptive sense because it basically gives foragers some physiological flexibility. At times of high activity, they can scale back on other functions and devote energy to activity without having to consume more calories, and then when they get back to a positive energy balance, they can pick up those functions that they left off on. But the question becomes, what functions are they giving up on? Herman and others have suggested that it could be reduced muscular activity for other behaviors, like postural behavior or fidgeting or that kind of thing. It could be reduced immune function, because the immune system is an energy hog of sorts. Or it could be reduced reproductive function. There is evidence to show that among modern foragers, that during periods of high activity, ovarian hormone production goes down in females. We also know that females who are highly active, like professional athletes, may become completely amenorrheic. They may shut down the reproductive system entirely. We know that among highly active males, that testosterone production will go down. So I looked at this with great optimism, thinking, okay, here's our link between energy budgets and reproduction, and the link is still there. So I thought, well, this must mean then, if we look at foraging people, we should see the lowest fertility in the most active groups, because they're going to have to be suppressing some of this reproductive function in order to supply their activity demands. So what I did was I went to those groups where we had good estimates from daily activity budgets or food calorie counts of physical activity levels, and for whom we also had measures of completed fertility. This is total fertility rate, which is different from completed fertility, but it's a fairly good measure of it. And unfortunately, there's not many groups where we have both data points. The data is fairly crude, but these are all natural fertility populations, pre-industrial populations, some of them forager horticulturalists, some of them foragers, some of them herders. And what I found is there's absolutely no relationship between fertility and physical activity level. And this is concerning. There are some groups like the Ache or the Samane, the Machiginga, who have very, very high activity levels, yet still maintain very high fertility. And in fact, in the literature, there's a question about whether there really is a relationship between energy budgets and fertility. On the one hand, people who work on reproductive ecology in humans say that there is clear evidence that reproductive physiology responds to energy balances, and that this is adaptively important as it ties human reproduction to the local ecology. And I would feel that Cecile's work on the baboons is also in the same vein, that there are clear links between energy budgets, activity levels, and fertility. But demographers are quick to point out that little of the variation in fertility in modern human populations can be explained by variation in activity levels. And in fact, or in energy budgets for that matter, and in fact, in the contemporary world, the most energetically stressed populations have the highest fertility. So I think that the challenge before us is to sort of figure out how is it in those groups that are maintaining high physical activity levels, what mechanisms, whether physiological or behavioral, are they using to allow females to still find that energy to reproduce? Because there's no free lunch here. It still takes calories to produce new cells. It takes calories to grow a baby Neanderthal or a baby modern human. And those calories have got to come from somewhere. So I think that's the challenge before us. I'll just say in conclusion that this leads me to think a couple things about what Neanderthals are doing. This is entirely hypothetical, but I think that first off, the Neanderthals must have had a sexual division of labor. And this is something that Dan Lieberman mentioned. A sexual division of labor can actually increase foraging efficiency, and it can be a way of having the males pay the caloric cost of high mobility, have them pay the mobility costs, while females are storing more or saving more energy for reproduction and for fertility. Mary Steiner and Steve Kuhn wrote a great article in 2006 called What's a Mother to Do, where they basically argued that Neanderthal social group sizes were too small to support a sexual division of labor. I think they must have had a sexual division of labor, because I think if females were out foraging as intensively as males, that would have cramped their fertility even more. Now, before I get to these other two points, I'll simply point out that a female's fertility is simply a function of her reproductive lifespan, which is the age at which she has her last birth minus the age at which she has her first birth, divided by her average interbirth interval. And one other thing about a sexual division of labor is it helps to protect females from some of those sources of mortality which are out there in the foraging world, like predation and hunting accidents and hypothermia and things like that, and may simply help females live longer to increase the average reproductive lifespan a little bit more. Secondly, I think that males must have supported lactation in Neanderthals. And Jean-Jacques mentioned a study. There is work in foragers that show that among those couples in which the female has a male who is directly supporting her lactation by bringing calories to her, her interbirth intervals are on average shorter than those females who lack a male helper like that. And so I think that male Neanderthals must have been directly supporting lactation. I love this reconstruction by Elizabeth Daines, and I put it up here to remind me to say, given that high adult mortality and the fact that most Neanderthals were dying by age 40, there probably were not a lot of grandmothers around to support fertility. But males could have done that by reducing the interbirth interval somewhat. And then finally, while it's contentious, I think that Neanderthals must have had faster life histories, and I think that females began reproducing faster. If we set this to 40, and we use a modern forager average interbirth interval of 3.3 years, it's hard to imagine Neanderthals weaning babies faster than that. You have to set the age at first birth at about 15 in order to get the kind of fertility that you need to give the Neanderthals even a fighting chance. Among modern foragers, the average age at first birth is about 18. So I think that they were getting into the reproductive market earlier as well. So that's it. Thank you very much.